WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Perhaps the most interesting country in the world right now is Turkey and the United States' weird relationship with it. If you like the U.S. using sanctions in support of human rights, you will like what Trump and Pence are doing there right now. If you don't like selective outrage only when Christian human rights are violated, you won't.
To President Erdogan and the Turkish government, I have a message on behalf of the President of the United States of America. Release Pastor Andrew Brunson now, or be prepared to face the consequences.
What consequences?
The United States will impose significant sanctions on Turkey until Pastor Andrew Brunson is free.
Mike Pence the other day, and by the way, sanctions imposed and retaliatory tariffs by Turkey, too. If you like an independent Muslim-majority country, both belonging to NATO but standing up to the United States, you'll like what Turkey's doing. If you don't like an authoritarian strongman steamrolling a Muslim democracy to impose religious law and the President of the United States praising him for it, you won't.
Thank you very much, and it's a great honor and privilege because he's become a friend of mine. To introduce President Erdogan of Turkey. He's running a very difficult part of the world. He's involved very, very strongly, and frankly, he's getting very high marks. And he's also been working with the United States. We have a great friendship. As countries, I think we're right now as close as we have ever been. And a lot of that has to do with the personal relationship. So, President, thank you very much. It's a great honor to have you in the United States.
Trump with strongman Erdogan last year, just as Erdogan was cracking down on dissent. Last month at the NATO summit, Trump fist-bumped Erdogan just before calling Europe a foe of the United States. But this month, we're imposing sanctions on Turkey for the reasons we stated. Confused yet? And if you don't like a head of state appointing his questionably qualified son-in-law to run important parts of the government, well, you won't like Turkey or the United States very much right now. Jared, meet Bayrat. Oh, and if you have money in the stock market, you might want to pay attention because Turkey's tanking currency may be plunging the world into the next great international debt crisis. Like right now, like yesterday and today. With us now to help unpack all that luggage, including all that baggage, are Amanda Sloat from the Brookings Institution. She was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, responsible for U.S. relations with Turkey in the Obama administration, and Nihal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Amanda and Nihal, thanks so much for coming on. Hi there.
Hi. Thank you for the invitation.
And we open the phones in this segment first for any Turkish Americans listening right now or anyone else with a connection to Turkey. Help us report this story and why it matters, or tell us your story. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Amanda, let's start here, and there are so many places we could enter after all that. But who is Pastor Andrew Brunson, and why has Turkey detained him?
So Andrew Brunson is an American Christian evangelical pastor who has been living in southern Turkey for over 20 years, running a church and preaching with the Christian community there. He got arrested in late 2016. That was part of a state of emergency that was imposed after the coup attempt against Erdogan and the Turkish government in July of 2016. Following the coup, the Turkish government took a number of security measures to crack down on people that it thought were responsible for the coup, and unfortunately, it became a much more expansive crackdown. And so Andrew Brunson, as well as other Americans and many others, got swept up as part of this post-coup crackdown.
Nihal, why was Pastor Brunson in Turkey from North Carolina? And might there be any truth to Turkey's charges that are terrorism related, or is he simply a religious and political prisoner?
Well, he had lived in Turkey for decades. He helped run a church in the city of Izmir, and he, you know, often spoke very, very much about his love for the country. And you know, in terms of his involvement with this alleged coup attempt, that's very much something where a lot of people feel like it's deeply unclear, and that the charges against him are unfair. But you know, I think he is like many other Christian evangelicals who go overseas with a sort of missionary zeal to some of the Muslim countries. You go there and you do what you can in a generally quiet way in some of these countries. And Turkey is one of those places where they have generally let Christians live and work there without much of a problem.
Reportedly, Nihal, there was almost a deal for Brunson's freedom about a week ago, but Turkey then upped the ante and the deal fell apart, at least for now. Do you know what happened?
Well, there was an agreement, this is all reportedly, to get someone who had been held, a Turkish person who had been held in Israel, to be freed in exchange for Andrew Brunson to be freed. And my understanding is that the deal worked except for the part where Andrew Brunson was, instead of being freed from prison, he was put under house arrest. And that, the Americans felt like, was simply unacceptable. They had expected his full freedom, and so they decided to go in this very harsh route of imposing sanctions and making threats against, let's not forget, a NATO ally.
So the U.S. slapped sanctions on the personal U.S. assets of two Turkish officials, and then tariffs on Turkish exports to the United States, 20% on aluminum, 50% on steel. Amanda, as a former State Department official, is that unusual, using tariffs not just as trade policy, but as political leverage?
Yes, using the economic sanctions certainly is. And this seems to be a favored tool of President Trump at the moment. You'll remember that he has similarly imposed sanctions on our European allies, on our Canadian allies, and now on Turkey. And what is frustrating all of these countries is that they are not being done on economic grounds, but they are being posed on national security grounds. The sanctions that were imposed on the two ministers, these Magnitsky sanctions, were initially developed to deal with human rights abuses in Russia. So as Nihal said, we now have the rather extraordinary situation where a tool that was designed to be used against Russia is now being used against one of our NATO allies.
And the tariffs?
The tariffs is, I mean, the administration has been very clear that they are not doing it for trade purposes, but they are doing it for national security reasons. And it's the same justification that the administration used to impose these sanctions on other European countries, which seems pretty extraordinary and unprecedented, especially to be using them against allies.
Amanda, a lot of progressives might think it's a good thing to use economic punishments of one kind or another to enforce human rights, to pressure a government that's committing religious persecution, as they may well be doing in this case. But, you know, like people would have argued, I think a lot of progressives didn't like back in the Clinton administration and even the George H.W. Bush administration when they took off the economic pressure on China and let them join the World Trade Organization and things like that, despite China's human rights record. So here's a case of using economic pressure in support of human rights, but it seems to be extremely selective because the Trump administration in generally has, Amanda, again, as a former State Department official, does it look this way to you, removed human rights as a consideration in U.S. foreign policy, except maybe in a case like this where somebody from a favored group, Christian pastors, is the persecuted one?
Lots of good questions there. I think the challenge here is that there have been a lot of people within the State Department that have been advocating much more broadly for Americans that are being seen as being held and imprisoned unjustly in Turkey. The attention has certainly focused on Andrew Brunson, who is this Christian pastor, which has mobilized a lot of evangelical support within the country. But I think it's important for listeners to understand there are also other Americans, including a NASA scientist who's a dual national. There are several Turkish employees of U.S. consulates, others who are being held as part of this broader sweep. And I think what's been particularly problematic is that Turkish President Erdogan embarked on hostage diplomacy by making a statement over a year ago that he would give the one cleric back in exchange for the other. The cleric he's talking about here in the United States is Fethullah Gulen, an Islamic cleric that the Turks blame for perpetuating the July 2016 coup attempt. And so the frustration has been that this has become a hostage situation where Americans are being held as a bargaining tool for getting other things that the Turkish government wants. On the broader question, I think it certainly is within the authority of the United States to take a stand against its citizens that are being wrongly imprisoned, as well as to take a stand against human rights violations in other countries. The question is the tools that you use to do this. And I think certainly where we have seen the U.S. go is almost with the nuclear option in terms of going very big and very directly targeting the Turkish economy. And there's questions about whether or not that is ultimately going to achieve their political objective, as well as what the economic consequences are going to be for that Turkey, as well as for globally and potentially coming back to the United States.
We're talking about arguably the most interesting country in the world right now, Turkey, and the United States' weird relationship with it. Interesting and extremely fraught, and we haven't even gotten to what's on all the front pages yet today, which is the collapse of the Turkish currency and implications for the global economy. But we invite your phone calls at 212-433-WNYC, especially if you have any connection to Turkey, 212-433-9692, with Nahal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, and Amanda Sloat from the Brookings Institution. She was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State responsible for U.S. relations with Turkey in the Obama administration. Greg in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Greg.
Yeah, hi, Brian. How are you?
Okay, thank you.
Good, good. You know, this is the height of irony, Brian. Love the segment, but I have to put this in some historical context. As you know, the Turks purged over 1.5 million Armenians at the end of the First World War, and the American government did nothing about it at that time. And now and the Armenians were Christians. Now we're all up in arms about protecting a few Christians that are being abused by the Turkish government. The fact is, the American government's had a very schizophrenic relationship with Turkey, casting them as either the angels or the devils, depending on, you know, what era we're talking about. And I just want to make sure there's some historical context. As you say, Brian, it's a weird relationship. It's been like that for 120 years or more. And frankly, you know, I don't understand where we're coming from. So I just want to throw that in there.
Greg, fair enough. Thank you very much. We're going to take a break and then continue with Amanda and Nahal. We will get into Erdogan's response to the sanctions, which was to call them a Zionist evangelical plot. Those are two adjectives you don't usually hear paired, Zionist evangelical. And then we will talk about the precipitous decline in the Turkish currency, their lira, and the implications, and take more of your phone calls. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we explain the deteriorating relationship between the U.S. and Turkey and the deteriorating state of the Turkish currency, which is on all the front pages probably around the world if they're looking at international economic news. Certainly, it's top of mind on Wall Street this morning with Nahal Tusi from Politico and Amanda Sloat from the Brookings Institution and a former State Department official responsible for relations with Turkey in the Obama administration. As I said before the news, before the break, Nahal, part of Erdogan's response to the sanctions that the U.S. imposed was to call them a Zionist evangelical plot. Again, two adjectives I'm not sure I've ever seen put quite together like that before. How does that rhetoric, though, fit into Erdogan's governance generally?
Well, it is very interesting because over the past decade, Erdogan has become increasingly authoritarian on a number of levels. And especially since the July 2016 coup attempt, he and his allies have taken over large parts of the government and also institutions like the media. And he, in many ways, has a lot of control over what Turks hear and read, much more than before. And so when he goes out there and makes these comments, blames the Americans or outsiders for everything, it's an attempt to whip up kind of the nationalist fervor in Turkey. And it's also kind of a way for him to distract, you could argue, from the major economic problems that have been taking place in Turkey, of which the Turkish lira's drop in value is just one. And the question is how long Erdogan, who, you know, in many ways is considered one of the most successful leaders in Turkish history, how long he can get away with that sort of appeal to the Turkish people, even as the economy gets worse and worse and worse.
In that context, Amanda, again, as a former State Department official responsible for U.S. relations with Turkey, can you give us 100 years of Turkish history in 100 seconds? The Armenian genocide aside, which we covered with a caller, specifically, why did the leader Ataturk make Turkey a secular nation that leads toward Europe? And how much have you watched from your post at the State Department Erdogan move away from that, move the whole country away from that?
Well, 100 years of Turkish history is complicated. So when the Ottoman Empire broke up, as you said, you had Kemal Ataturk, who was the leader of the country, and he really ended up introducing a lot of the principles of secularism and modernism. And so part of the challenge has been this struggle between secular forces and more sympathetic Islamist forces within the country. And so when Erdogan came to office, he had an Islamist background himself, but presented a very friendly face to a Western audience. He made a significant amount of economic reforms, which really made the country a much more dynamic economy and is the explanation for a certain amount of his success within the country. He actually ended up partnering with Fethullah Gulen, who was later accused of leading this coup, as the two of them, who both had these Islamist orientations, wanted to try and push back on some of the forces that were seen as preserving the secular nature of some of these institutions, which included the military. There has been a history of coups in Turkey over the last 100 years, with the military seeing itself as the defender of this secular constitution. So part of what Erdogan and Gulen did together was to try and empower the state and to try and push out some of the secularists that they believed were operating within the government and also within the military. Problems then arose once that was done, and these two men turned on each other and began engaging in a power struggle. So what we saw was a lot of tit-for-tat activities over a couple-year period that ended up culminating in the coup in 2016. At the same time, Erdogan went from having been initially very Western-facing, which led the European Union to open accession negotiations with him. It led President Obama to believe that this was somebody he could work with. It was the first country, second to Canada, that he made a bilateral visit to as president. He spoke of Turkey having the potential to serve as a model democracy with the Arab Spring happening in the Middle East. And so there's been a lot of disappointment in the West over the last couple of years when Turkey seems to have been shifting away from what initially was a very pro-democratic, pro-liberal, pro-Western orientation.
Let's take another call. Tom in Gramercy, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Brian. Thanks so much for this topic. It's really interesting to me. I've been kind of studying it for a little while, but I just wanted to, your guest has done a great job of explaining the situation, but I just wanted to reference a few things about why the U.S. might be engaging, or the Trump administration is engaging in this. The first thing I just wanted to mention is that Turkey in April specifically, against the objections of NATO members, made a deal to buy Russian missiles. at the same time as they were buying American-made F-35 fighter jets, which, of course, you know, our most advanced fighter jet. And so part of the concern was, one, the sanctions, but two, also that that Russian engineers would be at the airbase at the same time as we were getting these F-35 planes. And just as a further sort of context, you know, we have to remember that Turkey really hasn't been behaving like a NATO ally very much in the last couple of years, especially with their actions against the Kurds. You know, there's a lot of evidence that they were allowing IS members traveling to Turkey.
ISIS.
You know, it's not just that it's two strong men sort of yelling at each other. It's there's a lot of issues with Turkey's behavior, and it's and to me, it seems very much like Trump thought he had a deal, and then realized, you know, that he didn't, and took this sort of, was like, that's it. This was the last straw. So maybe that's why he used the nuclear option.
Tom, thank you very much. And of course, he doesn't mean nuclear option in the literal sense, but you know, when he talks about a NATO member not acting very much like a NATO ally, and then leaning toward Russia. I could think of another country that could apply to recently. But Nihal, what is that story with respect to Turkey? Are they playing Russia off the United States and the United States off Russia in a certain respect?
It does appear like they are doing that. In a sense, it's like they don't want to put all their eggs in the U.S. basket. And so there is, you know, a turn toward Russia to a certain degree. The purchase of the S-400 missiles is actually something that really, really upset members of Congress. And they really felt like it was something of a betrayal, especially when the U.S. was going to giving the Turks the F-35s. But that is, again, one of those many, many things that has happened in the relationship over the past several years that has just, you know, led some people to even wonder whether Turkey really fits in the NATO mold anymore, especially if you have a president who seems intent on increasingly consolidating his power and turning toward Russia when, you know, NATO views Russia as a major threat. So this is, it's just one of those many, many things. Let me just say that, you know, when I want to write a story about Turkey, I always find it so difficult to keep it short and sweet because there's just so much to say.
I know. That's why we're doing a little expanded segment here and trying to explain to our listeners some of these confusing strands that make Turkey maybe the most interesting, but also the most complex as it pertains to the United States and even maybe internally, country in the world right now. And Amanda, kind of to that point, would we be having this tension with Turkey? Would the Trump administration, representing the United States at this moment, be having these strained relations with Turkey were it not for their captivity of Pastor Brunson? Because I could see a Trump, Erdogan, Putin axis forming where if Trump is leaning toward Russia and Erdogan is leaning toward Russia, and Trump has already declared Erdogan his buddy until this whole thing came up, that there would be some weird realignment internationally that would be taking place that includes these three major countries.
Well, I think your previous caller made a number of very good points, that while we're focusing right now on Pastor Brunson as the precipitating factor for the current crisis, there is, in fact, a history of grievances that both sides have developed. President Erdogan published an op-ed in the New York Times over the weekend, and he outlined what Turkish grievances have been, primarily that the U.S. has not taken sufficiently seriously their security concerns, both in terms of Gulen and the coup attempt, and then also U.S. cooperation with the Kurds in Syria, which the caller referenced. And Turkey's concern has been that those Kurds are affiliated with the PKK, which is a domestic terrorist organization that's been operating in Turkey. From the American side, there have been questions that have been growing about whether or not Turkey is a reliable ally, as Nihal was suggesting, both in the sense of engaging in hostage diplomacy, like we were talking about, but also given their interest in purchasing Russian missile defense technology. That's actually been a story that's been running for the last couple of years. The U.S. with Raytheon has been trying to sell Patriot missiles to Turkey. And I think Turkey really has been looking for the best deal, and they're also looking to develop their own domestic sector. So you may remember a couple of years ago, it looked like the Turks were going to buy a system from China. That ended up falling through. Now they are looking at buying this system from Russia. So some of this may be less about strategic orientation and more about Turkey looking to get a good deal. Turkey also has a really complicated relationship with Russia. It has some energy dependence on them. It has economic dependence on them. And you may recall it was only 3 years ago that Turkey shot down a Russian jet that violated its airspace in Syria, which led President Putin to slap economic sanctions on Turkey, leading a year later for Erdogan to apologize to Putin as a way of getting those sanctions lifted. And even though they're working together in Syria, they're actually on opposite sides of that conflict, with Putin propping up the Assad regime and Erdogan backing forces that are trying to overthrow Assad. So things aren't quite so straightforward in terms of what Turkey's better options might be in terms of being allied with the West. But certainly, I think for President Trump, this issue of Andrew Brunson has become very personal. I think he feels like the administration has done a lot of things over the last year to try and address some of these Turkish grievances. And so I think he felt quite personally let down when Erdogan was not willing to deliver on the one thing that he asked of him.
Nelson in Jersey City, I think, has an important question tying this to U.S. national security. Hi, Nelson. You're on WNYC.
Hey, good morning, Brian. Love the show.
Thank you.
I was stationed in Turkey twice, and the military, we've always had a great relationship with their military, whether I was at the Joint U.S. Military Aid Mission to Turkey, and whether it was generals and generals or even field officers and our NCOs, we had these great relationships with them. And one thing you were talking about, 100 years of Turkish history, another part of their Turkish history is military coups. The first time I was there in the 1980s, it was under martial law. That being said, what is our relationship with the Turkish military today? I mean, military to military. And secondly, what is the end game? What's going to happen to our troops over there? We have thousands of troops, tons of aircraft, missions in Syria and Iraq, whether one supports those missions or not. I mean, Turkey is very important to maintaining those missions. And I guess I'll take my answer off the air. But thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Amanda. We have tons of troops over there, and why do we have troops in Turkey?
First I'll say that Nelson is right, that we've always had very good relationships between our military, and those relationships have continued. There was a certain amount of disruption following the coup, with a large number of officers and soldiers that were removed from their position, either having been accused of participating in the coup, plotting in the coup, or just general reorganization. So it's taken some time to restore some of those relations. But our relations between the militaries does continue. One of the main bases that we have there is Incirlik Air Base down in southern Turkey. And we have a large number of troops that have been stationed down there. And it's also been one of the hubs that we have been operating out of for some of our air campaign that we have done in Syria and elsewhere. So at the moment, there is nothing that is happening in terms of the position of these troops. They are continuing to operate there. It is within the realm of possibility that Turkey could decide that they want to kick us out of Incirlik Air Base. That is something that they have threatened to do in the past when they have been unhappy with something that the U.S. has done. That is not a threat that has been put on the table as of yet, but it is something that could be in the Turkish toolbox.
And Trump ran on pulling back the U.S. military from around the world, but he hasn't done it. Before we run out of time, the big stories today are that Turkey's currency crisis is already roiling the stock market, and worse, it could trip off other emerging markets to have currency crises, causing real global pain, because there is the underlying weakness of global investors having avoided the dollar in recent years because of low interest rates in the United States. So they were more willing to take more risks in developing countries for greater returns. Now that interest rates are coming back up in the U.S., it's easier to flee countries like Turkey when they get into some financial uncertainty, And if that becomes a wave that gets contagious and goes from country to country, kaboom, in a financial sense. Are either of you monetary geeks enough to know where we are on that scale? Nihal, do you have any view on this?
I am not an expert by any means on that front, but I will say that any time you have a currency in a place like Turkey, which is so geostrategically important and economically integrated, and you have these kinds of wild valuations, ups and downs, that, you know, it's a threat, and it's a deep concern. And the question is what steps Erdogan is willing to take to stabilize the currency, even if that means perhaps releasing Andrew Brunson and improving the relationship with the U.S., which is something that does affect investors' views of the Turkish economy.
Can I just add two things
on the economy? One of the problems is the way the Turkish economy is structured. They are very dependent on dollar inflows. And so you've got large and medium-sized companies that are over-leveraged in terms of dollars that they have loaned or that they have borrowed. So once you have the depreciation of the lira, the dollar becomes much more expensive to repay these loans. And so the concern is that you could end up having some of these holding companies go bankrupt, which then ends up affecting banks. And then that ends up contributing to some of the global contagion, and I think is raising concerns about investor confidence in the economy. The second issue is that Erdogan has a false economic belief that low interest rates equals low inflation. Turkey's inflation rate is currently over 15%, which is three times the Turkish government's target of 5%. And he has been very clear and made investors very nervous about saying that he does not want the central bank to raise interest rates and wants to limit the independence of the central bank. So one of the things that Turkey could do to address this current problem is to raise interest rates. But this is something that's anathema to Erdogan. Final problem is he does not have a lot of financial and economic experience in his cabinet. And as you mentioned at the top, the person that's responsible for economic policy is his son-in-law.
Yes, one of the triggers for the currency decline I read was Erdogan appointing his son-in-law as finance minister. Jared, are you listening? Questions about the qualifications of the son-in-law for complex economic policy decisions. We're just about out of time. I'm just curious if, Nihal, there's any reason to believe that the current story and the Pastor Brunson story are related, or should we just see these as two separate things?
Oh, no, I think that definitely there's a relationship, and I think that's partly because the Trump administration makes there be a relationship when it does things like impose sanctions or tariffs in particular because of what is, a traditionally more of a human rights or foreign policy issue. So when the Trump administration links the two things, I definitely think there is a connection.
Nihal Tusi from Politico, Amanda Sloat from the Brookings Institution. Thank you both so much for this sprawling segment on Turkey. Now,
thank you.
A lot more people in the New York area understand a lot more than they did a half hour ago. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come.